So I welcome you this evening to a second talk by our last speaker, Mr. Ismail Valesco. And the title of this evening's talk is Religion, a Cause of Unity or Disunity? And since Mr. Ismail Valesco being so familiar with us requires no introduction, I'll let him go ahead and have the floor right now.
Thank you. I thought for the title too. Really, I suppose the question that I thought might be worth addressing today was last time we discussed the nature of belief and how does one reach belief in the supernatural and discussed how the belief in God was not necessarily something that one chose. That was the discussion, that when you find something true, you find the true whether you want to or not. In the same way that when you find something beautiful, you find it beautiful whether you want to or not. That is very different to the decision to link that that belief to a community. That is something where one does have a choice. So for example, I may find something to be true that somebody's telling me, but I don't necessarily have to join a group with them because I agree with what they've been telling me. So this whole notion of what does community mean, what does religion mean, and what possible point could there be to joining a religious community in the 21st century? And I think this is a very significant question in the 21st century, particularly, I think, for those of our generation and younger, who I think have developed quite a reluctance to commit or to identify with something outside of themselves in any binding way. And this stretches all the way from individual relationships. We tend to be quite hesitant about commitment into a marriage, for example, and particularly labeling it such, better kind of let's live together, let's build something, let's see how it goes, because it might end in tears kind of thing. So let's not risk it. And in the same way, I think with many more areas of our lives, we will be. There is no longer any such thing as the sort of 60-year job. You know, you join the company and you'll be there for the rest of your life. No, you are. Even as you join a job, you're already thinking of what your options are. I was just speaking to a friend who has. She lives in Tenerife. She's a nutritionist, very successful, and she's got 4 jobs at the moment. That have just kind of come to her because she is good and very professional, that's very well. And she was telling me she's about to go to an interview for a 5th job that she's not going to take. She knows she's not going to take it because she can't because it's got 4 and they have to completely transform the offer and they're not going to. So I said, why are you doing it? You know, she went through the trouble of applying for it, of putting in the CV, filling in the forms, going to the interview. Why are you wasting your time, their time? Well, that way, first of all, I find out what the competition are doing. Because then she finds out what this other company. And the other thing is that maybe in 2 or 3 years' time, they'll call me back about a different job. Because the 3rd job I had was from an interview that I did a year before that. And then a year later they said, oh yeah, we still have you, etc. So, you know, there is no sense of permanence to most of our identities now. Even when we do commit to a marriage now, the sort of the breakdowns, that the indices of breakdown are such that we kind of cross our fingers and hope that there isn't the kind of expectation of permanency. We can't take it for granted in almost any identity, not in our jobs, not in our, in no community, no social bond seems to be one that is liable to be taken for granted. Even our friendships, we might build a very solid friendship, but of course we live in a globalized world. So it might be that my best friend from school ends up living in China whilst I live in Nottingham. And sure, we'll always be friends, but maybe after 10 or 15 years, we'll drift away a bit. So there is no solid ground, as it were. And in this respect, I think there is, it is so much to ask to commit in that way to such immediate, palpable relationships. How much greater is the challenge of committing to a community based on supernatural claims? and associated with the concept of religion. And I think, again, let's explore this deficit further, this deficit in commitment. How does it manifest itself? We also speak about a democratic deficit in our societies, because fewer and fewer and fewer people go to vote, because fewer and fewer people feel inspired to somehow commit to that democratic process. There are obvious exceptions, like the recent American elections, because they had so much high drama. But on the whole, the trend has been one of an increasing democratic deficit. That's one of the drivers for the expansion of participatory democracy, as opposed to purely representative democracy. So up to the first half of this century, the democratic ideal was almost exclusively representative. You voted for your MPs, and then you forgot about it, and trusted them to kind of get on with it. And if you didn't like it, you voted them out the next year. But as less and less people started voting, suddenly the majority party only had a minority of the support of the population. So that even if you had 50% of the votes, if only 30% of people voted, that gives you a mandate of 15% for your decisions in the whole country. This is something that democracies all over the world are struggling with. And so participatory democracy, in a way that is quite similar to the pattern of Baha'i community life, begins to expand. It's spaces for consultation, spaces for representation, sort of horizontal entries into the processes of decision making, as opposed to purely leaving it to the MPs and to the civil servants. So why then this resistance? I think I've mentioned some factors already. There is the enormous sense of flux and the enormous sense of change that creates insecurity. There is the collapse of relationships, more generally, that has created a kind of wariness before committing, because it's feelings that are involved, it's identity. We do not want to get hurt, so we play it by ear. We have had enormous collapses of mass movements, of the things that cohered all the way to the 70s, whole sectors of the population. So 1968 was a very famous year for youth movements. It's a curious thing because it appeared all over the world, and this kind of revolutionary youth movement. And it manifested itself completely different. In some places it was Woodstock and hippies, in other places it was Barracks, in other places, many different manifestations. But there was this sense of idealism and commitment to a vision, and people joined different movements. No longer religion primarily, except in the global south. So why? Why is this happening, and how does it speak to religion? I think that one of the indisputable facts of history is that there have been few forces as divisive historically as religion. There have been few conflicts around the world of any length and permanence that are not in some way entwined with religion. Sometimes for decades, sometimes for centuries, sometimes for more than centuries. Barriers that are perpetuated in the name of the I am this and I am not that. And so people accuse this generation of being apathetic, that we do not join things because we don't care, because we can't be bothered, because we are too materialistic or too individualistic or too selfish. My feeling is that that's not the case. My feeling is that actually it is that we have developed a measure of discernment, and that we've seen looking back where such collective identities have led us very frequently, particularly in the last century. I think if we took a longer view, we might have a more cyclical perspective, and we might see how identities flourish and give fruits and then reify and collapse. But really, for the last 150 years or so, it is quite hard to think of any identity that has not very quickly gone pear-shaped in a really bad way. And it is very hard to think of any religious identity that one cannot point to as a as a symptom of retrogression, of going back, of not advancing, of failing to embrace the challenges of today. So we have this very frequent word that Baha'is bump into all the time when they speak to their friends about the Baha'i faith. I like that very much, but I do not want to label myself. I do not want to label myself. I want to be myself. I don't want to be something other than myself. I don't want to lose my identity in some flag, in some tribe. I don't want to judge my decisions by an external source. I want to be free. And above all, I also do not want to separate myself by labeling myself. Because if I call myself something, my statement is really not just of what I am, but what I am not. If I say I am Christian, that means I am not Muslim, I am not Jew, I am not Catholic, I am not Buddhist. If I say I am Baha'i, it says I am not all these other faiths. Why label myself? I do not want to label myself. And that extends to all things. Our labels tend to be really quite, it's like I was mentioning last time, that we kind of come together around negatives. No to globalization, no to sort of neoliberalism, no to communism, no to something. But we no longer have any constructive point of cohesion. I think in the same way, our labels have been, or if we go into something positive, I mentioned before, they are very, very specific. So we might rally all together to stop wailing in one sea in Norway now. And that might bring lots of people together, or stop the war in Iraq, or something very specific and time-bound. But no cohesion beyond that, as it were. Our networks are loose, our bonds are soft. And likewise, the labels that we might take on will be, generally speaking, also ephemeral and secondary, contingent. So it might be that I am an accountant, for example. I might label myself that. Or I am a scientist by my career. I might feel comfortable with that. And even that, I'll feel a bit iffy. Because I might be sacked tomorrow. And then I might, like they were, I just read today, the Union Syrian uproar. Because they are offering 6-month traineeships to the to bankers that have been made redundant to become school teachers. And if they're very good, they will be fast-tracked to headmasters. So I was a banker, but now I'm a teacher after 6 months. Why? Because the banking system collapsed on me. So let's go to schooling. So we can label ourselves around such matters. We might label ourselves around hobbies. I am a ballroom dancer. I am a Wii fanatic. Maybe within that we'd have to define which Wii game specifically we identify closely with. But broader labels that before, not so long ago, just a few decades ago, would have mobilized many people. I am a socialist. I am a labor person. I am a Christian, I am any of these things. Those set out alarm bells. Now, the Baha'i perspective on this is that such a response, far from being irrational or unwarranted or unreasonable, is entirely legitimate. That what we are seeing is, globally speaking, and very clearly now, perhaps not so clearly when Baha'u'llah first foreshadowed it in the 19th century and said, the signs of impending afflictions and chaos can now be discerned, inasmuch as the prevailing order appears to be lamentably defective. So he looked at the order of the world, how the world was ordered, 19th century, this is a time of empire still, of colonialism. The Pope still had territories and armies and lands. You have Napoleon III, Queen Victoria, etc. And he looked at how the world order was organized around unbridled nationalism, around militarism, around a struggle for hegemony, for dominion, around inequalities, etc., around slavery, a thousand things. He looked at the way the world order was based, and he said, it spells trouble. You can see that impending convulsions and chaos are on the way, because the order of the world, the structure of the world, is defective. It needs reordering. So he said, soon will the present-day order be rolled up and a new one be spread out in its stead. And he said that the whole world, the equilibrium of the world, had been upset by the vibrating influence of this new world order. So there is this notion in many of the physical sciences, and there are here people who are much more qualified than me to address them, and I think this is an area that would be very usefully explored in more detail by those of you who have that expertise. But there is some, in the 90s, a theory that was very popular, very big, was complexity theory. I don't know if you've heard of it before. It's the science of how complexity emerges in systems, from something simple to something more complex, which applies primarily to life. So we began with sort of single cell organisms that have been growing progressively more complex till they eventually yielded sort of human beings and eventually human societies. And this is seen mathematically on all kinds of sort of modelings, etc. There are moments at which randomness seems to generate complexity. In a random way, nobody plans it just happens. And mathematically, this happens in the border between order and chaos. Systems that are too tightly ordered do not mutate enough to create that emergence of complexity. Systems that are too chaotic do not cohere enough to allow for that emergence of complexity. But in the edge between chaos and order, complexity arises. And these dynamic systems emerge. And the transition to complexity is one that we speak about emergent orders, how certain things contain emergent properties. So for example, I feel very unqualified because my background is a humanities. This is a complete layman's sort of dipping into this many years ago. But the notion that latent within a particular configuration is a subsequent order of greater complexity that will manifest itself if the conditions are right. So if you create the right conditions, a configuration of elements will interact in such a way that properties that are latent in them will emerge. And these emergent properties are the properties of a new order that leave behind the old one. And sometimes these changes of state are not straightforward. There is a man called Erwin Laszlo, a very famous systems theorist, who said that used catastrophe theory, another mathematical concept, where sort of change goes linearly like that, and then suddenly you have, when the state is about to change, this moment of turbulence that then stabilizes again into a new state. So for example, if you're heating up water, the water will heat up, and then suddenly there will be this ebullition, and then vapor will come. And eventually it will all be vapor, you know, from what began as water. So similarly speaking, the Baha'i vision is one of emergent order. Baha'i see that collective social evolution has been evolving from simpler units to more complex units. So a few thousand years ago, we were able to cohere around families. Our families got together and built clans. And that was the most complex unit of human organization, the clan. And eventually clans got together in order to collaborate, to get better resources, in order to defend themselves from rival clans, built alliances, etc., and became tribes. And likewise, tribes eventually ceased to be nomadic, began to settle, and you developed city-states. And eventually different city-states sort of cohered in not very linear ways, often full of conflict, and built nations and nation-states eventually. So this process has been quite quite consistent throughout history, this emergence of greater and greater levels of complexity in social organization. The meaning of community has been evolving accordingly. What community meant when you were a clan is very different to what community meant when you were a city, and it's very different to what community meant when you were a state. If you were a clan, your community was everyone. Everyone was your community, the entire unit. When you were a city, probably your community was more likely your neighborhoods or your trades or your guild or something like that. Different bases of community emerged as time went by. What the Baha'i teachings suggest is that what happened suddenly, or not so suddenly, but what crystallized, let's say, in the 19th century, was globalization, a process that begins way, way before, that has been going on all the time, all throughout history. Sort of societies, information flows, communications, transport have been improving. The interdependence of the world has been accelerating. But it seemed to have reached a tipping point where this dynamic became exponential around the 19th century. And so you have what we now tend to describe as globalization. Not in the narrow sense of sort of the globalization of the neoliberalist economic model, but in the broader sense of the interaction of all the different nations into sort of a single system, a single ecosystem, where the influences in one affected the whole system. This is something that Baha'u'llah foresaw then. He said, this is what's happening. The earth is but one country, and mankind is citizens. This was his assertion in mid-19th century. He said that basically what was going on was that the systems that we had were predicated on society being disaggregated in a planet, on having competing nations and competing classes. And that this system, very laboriously and very successfully and painfully achieved over centuries, that was that gave us sort of a parliamentary democracy, that gave us so many things, technology, capital flows, etc., was no longer adequate for the challenges that were coming. And therefore, anything built on those foundations, on the premises on which that order was designed, was bound to fail. Now, I think that failure has not been so obvious until quite recently. Many people warned against it, decried it, etc. But really, I think our generation is the first to really not have anywhere to look and not find the failure of this old way of doing it. Whether it be sort of colonialist approaches, whether it be extremes of poverty and wealth, whether it be militarism, whether it be racism, any legacy of that way of organizing ourselves, whether it be a political system based on parties whose role is to attack one another, all of these things seem to be bankrupt. Whether it be a financial system predicated on the premise of unlimited growth, when resources were finite. All these things have reached an ideological bankruptcy. So, if that is the case, why would you judge anything? Why would you commit to something that you intuitively feel is fragile or worse? Therefore, I think from a Baha'i perspective, as I understand it, it is quite a legitimate response to want to opt out to some extent, or at least to just manage without any sense of love or commitment to things as they are, to collectivities as they are, because that's what's failing. Now, nowhere is this more the case than in religion. Baha'u'llah said, if religion, the purpose of religion is to foster social unity. To foster unity. Why? Because unity is what creates civilization, this increasing of complexity. That's what evolution, social evolution is about. That's what enables us to achieve greater things. The reason we didn't have the technological advances a few thousand years ago that we have now is because our capacity to collaborate was much more limited. We were not able to collaborate. At the moment, this chair in which I'm sitting probably involve tens of thousands of people out there at some point in the chain, from the production of the materials to the marketing of it, to the sort of design, to the factory, the whole thing, just this, involves a level of collaboration that would be unthinkable, completely incomprehensible a few centuries ago. So, if religion becomes an obstacle to this, Baha'u'llah says, if religion becomes a source of disunity, of division, then its absence is better than its presence. It is better to be without religion. In that sense, to reject religion becomes a religious act. Because if I am truly religious, and I read the Bible, and I am told that that Jesus lived this extraordinarily difficult life, he offered his life, all his followers were persecuted, they gave all of this for the purpose of uniting humanity, of creating love, of saying love your neighbor as yourself, love your enemies, of eradicating hate, of eradicating division, then, as a sincere Christian, I am in a dilemma. Because the moment I want to practice this, and I want to join with other Christians, I have to choose against which Christian I have to define myself, let alone non-Christians. Because if I call myself a Methodist, then I am certainly not Orthodox. And if I am Orthodox, if I join an Orthodox congregation, I'll probably not look very kindly on the evangelicals, etc. So I have a paradox here, that in order that if I embrace the religious identity, the religious community that is available to me to express my religious identity, I, to some greater or lesser extent, violate the very basis of my identity. So, as we look through history, as we look through manipulations that have been carried out in the name of religion, abuses that have been carried out, and even today, at the enormous conflicts that exist in the name of religion, or that are aggravated, or perpetuated, or legitimized through religion, it is quite a religious act to say, I ain't joining any religion. So, and that's one aspect. The other aspect to that is also, because this not labeling myself has to do with that, has to do with not being divided from others, but it also has to do with autonomy, with the autonomy of our own independent investigation of truth. I don't want to be told what to think. I don't want to go somewhere and belong to a congregation that tells me this is how I should live my life. How I should live my life should follow organically from the truths that I become persuaded. And so I find that in different congregations, in different communities, I find elements there that are in tension with what I believe, well, with how I should live my life. And finally, I think that the third barrier to me is that religion has changed from its origins to now. In its origins, all the great religions were not congregational movements. They were not, the goal of those religions were not to get small groups of people or large groups of people to be together apart from the world and have nice cups of tea and have a lovely experience and pray and eat nice food and love each other and that's it. They were great forces of civilization. They were these huge things. To say, I am a Buddhist at the beginning of the Buddhist generation was to invite persecution. And the early monks, there are many stories of the early Buddhist monks experiencing rejection, prejudice, etc. It was a huge statement. It was a transformation in the social fabric of life. And what was most challenging about each of these identities was that they tended to include all the previous ones that had been fragmented. So for example, when Moses came, he united tribes that had been at odds with one another and built a greater unit, a nation. When Jesus came, he was able to reconcile. To say, I am a Christian, did not mean I am not a Muslim, a Jew, a... To say I am a Christian meant I include all the other identities. I can be a Gentile. I can be a Syrophoenician. I can be a Samaritan. I can be a Jew. And the moment I say I'm a Christian, I am a brother with you. We are one. That's what it meant then. And the Bible has amazing stories that I don't have time to go into, but have wonderful stories of this transgression, of how Jesus transgresses ethnic boundaries and really and identity boundaries, and first of all intensifies them for his disciples and then breaks them and demonstrates that actually to be a Christian means to be one with all. So each new religion brings a more inclusive identity. The same happened with Islam. Islam recognized Christianity and recognized Judaism. But it expanded it to all the sort of pagan Arabs that were there, and eventually to a much wider polity, as it were, than that had been the case before. But as time goes by, and society evolves, and the insights of each generation and of each religious message, the social insights become absorbed, and new civilizations flourish, Buddhist civilization, Hindu civilization, Christian civilization, art, science, physics, music, so many things that are linked to this incredible leavening influence, suddenly it starts becoming a nostalgic thing. It starts becoming a return to the past. And each new movement within Christianity, within Catholicism, for example, before it split, the monastic movements that emerged were attempts to go back to the purity of the original. And eventually, the Reformation was the same thing in a more radical way. Let's go back to the purity, let's go back to the, so we split and we break up. Because it's no longer looking forward. Now, what is the Baha'i perspective on this? It is that actually, the whole concept of a religious congregation has become out of date. That it is socially nice, but not relevant to the needs of society. So, the reluctance to join a congregation is one that, again, from a Baha'i perspective, seems eminently rational. So if all this is the case, why in the world would one want to call oneself Baha'i? Why in the world would one want to join a Baha'i community? Because it's interesting, in one of the things that I haven't yet found anything to contradict it is that I noticed something, that the Baha'i teachings have two types of teachings, all based on the individual acceptance of sort of the truth of Baha'u'llah. If I don't accept it, I don't have to follow any of the teachings. But if I were to be persuaded of the truth of Baha'u'llah's teaching, then there are two types of teachings. Some are enjoined upon me, some of them are, let's say, encouraged of me, and others are obligatory on me as a Baha'i. So some I can, I should do, but I don't have to do. And others, very few, I am expected to do them, I have to do them. Nobody polices them. Actually, something I will come back to this. The interesting thing I noticed here is that I can't think, and if anyone can, I'd be really grateful because I've been carrying this for many years here, that no one has yet sort of come up with an example. I can't think of a single example of a law that is obligatory in the Baha'i faith that is communal. All the obligatory laws are absolutely individual and personal. So the law of prayer, the law of fasting, the law of contributing to the funds, the law of not drinking alcohol, various things like that. These are laws that nobody can say whether I'm keeping them or not. And if I break them, nobody can judge me for them. It's completely up to me. It's a private thing. I can live them completely. I can fulfill all the obligatory principles without ever meeting another Baha'i. And all the collective activities, all the collective practices of the Baha'i community are voluntary. We are strongly encouraged to go to what Baha'is call a 19-day feast. Every month the Baha'is get together and have a feast and consult. Every Baha'i is told to go. But no one is, it's not an obligatory thing. It's a desirable thing. Any communal thing that I can think of has the same character. So this is very interesting because it means that I could technically fulfill all the Baha'i requirements and never let anybody know that I'm a Baha'i. Why join them? Why label myself? Even within the Baha'i teachings, I don't need to join. Really. If I believe in it and I try to practice these things, that's it. What's your uncle? Why would I ever join it? Well, this is where it comes, this is where it becomes interesting. That I think we have associated communal religious identity with fear and guilt and judgment. I belong to this community. If I am a Christian, I join a church because otherwise, what happens? You're not a good Christian, or God will judge you. If you, I'm not in the mosque, or if I'm not, if I don't call myself a Muslim, I don't know. There is an element where we identify religious belonging with a must. Why must I? Why do I have to? Who's is God forcing me to do it? One of the interesting things for me is that in the Baha'i community, in the Baha'i laws, no one forces you to be communal. No one forces you to join with anybody else. So why join? Okay. Now let's take a completely different take on things. Let's look at community. Not at religion, not at identity, but at community. And at the world today. What is happening in the world today? What is the historic moment in which we live in? Most of us are not really wanting to look too closely because it's not very pretty. There is a website that I highly recommend to all of you called Doc Martinson. Not Chris Martinson. Doc Martinson out of the book, not that. Chris Martinson. He has a crash course, which is a wonderful example of communication of ideas in an amazing, simple way. And it's a course, it lasts about 3 hours, but it's broken into segments of 5 to 10 minutes, so you can see it over a period of time. And it basically sort of number crunches along three main variables, the sort of finances, the financial system, the energy crisis, or the energy generally, and peak oil, and climate change, sorry. These are the three things that it looks at. And on the basis of this, it predicts that the next 20 years are likely to see very, very, very radical changes as all kinds of things that we take for granted collapse that sustain the current world order. This is something that is no longer left of field. Actually, it was predicted in 1972 by the Club of Rome in a very famous paper called The Limits of Growth. Which I just read today, actually, a paper seeing how that was a mathematical model of how the world might look like over the next sort of up to 2100 and predicting that we would outstrip sustainability within the first few decades of the 21st century, leading to all kinds of really not pretty scenarios on a big scale. And somebody then looked at it 30 years later and tied the predictions to the actual data that we had and to see how well the model worked, how predictive it proved. And we seem to be fairly on target. And they had three scenarios. The scenario is everything as is, nobody changes anything, people just carry on. The other one is great technological innovation, and the third one was everyone changes their lifestyle and we all sort of develop an equilibrium, etc. Even in that scenario, things were really tough, but much, much later. Now, within this scenario, the numbers fitted quite closely. Surprise, surprise, the carry-on, nothing's changed, right? Because that has really been the policy, globally speaking. And it's interesting that somebody wrote about the notion of apocalyptic time. This was someone who studied apocalyptic movements in the Middle Ages. And how when people expected the world to end, periodically over history, people expect the world to end. It's a common human predisposition. Ah, the world's going to end. You know, it's the year 1000, it's the year 2000, it's the year sort of 1011 or whatever, or 1111 or anything like that, 666 or whatever it is. The day it's coming, it's all going to end. It's all going to end, save yourself. You've seen the guys with a sort of sign. The world is about to end. And what he says is that this consciousness triggers in the people who partake of it apocalyptic time, the sense of time that's different. So if the world's going to end, you don't act the same way. You know, if you've got 20 years, maybe you invest in something else, you go into the hills, you sell everything, you do something strange. And interestingly enough, because most of the great religions come in apocalyptic times, what he suggests is that apocalyptic times can be very destructive. people lose their, just park their reason for a second and go, ah, and do all kinds of good and terrible things. But it's also a very creative time, a time that allows for flexibility, that allows people to question things that are taken for granted. So the printing press, technology suddenly grows because people want to share the message. New social ways of organizing oneself become possible, etc. One, a friend of mine, Arturo López Claros, who he's one of the foremost world economists. He worked at the IMF and was the director of the World Economic Forum and all kinds of people, really top world economists. He, when the crash happened, all these terrible financial things happened, he wrote an interesting letter to the Financial Times saying, people are really worried that things will collapse. I'm less worried about that. I'm more worried that things will recover soon and we will have missed the opportunity to make the fundamental changes to the economy that this crisis presents us with. One of the interesting things that all these various futurologists, very rigorous, we're not talking here the person with the pan, you know, with a sign that says the world's going to end. We're talking teams of the world's brightest sort of mathematicians, economists, sociologists, psychologists coming in interdisciplinarily and trying to say, where are the trends leading us? And it's all fairly uncontroversial now because it's a chorus of consensus. You know, people quibble around the details. Is this happening or is this happening? Is it happening now? Is it happening later? But wherever you go into trends, into the world, you know that the next 50 years, which we'll all live through here, are going to be extraordinarily different and extraordinarily tough. And we are living at the moment, our consciousness hasn't yet quite caught up with it. We still kind of are living as if we could sustain where we are indefinitely. What all these people suggest then is what's going to be precious as life changes? What is going to acquire value if finances begin to look as shifty as they do? What will be the key capital that we have to deal with the crisis ahead? And what a great many thinkers converge in saying is that the key capital will be our social capital, our community, our networks. I don't know everything, and I don't have access to all resources, but if I know people who do, I'm going to be better placed than someone who's quite isolated to adapt to the challenge. So if I lose my job tomorrow and I don't know anybody else, I may be in for a bit of a shock. Well, being for a bit of a shock, whatever. But perhaps if I have some really close friends who can maybe put me off if I can't pay the mortgage, suddenly my life is different. And if I, you know, if I actually know how to do something really well, I could create a business with someone else, etc. So this unity becomes more and more important, more vital. Community becomes quite significant. And then we return then to what the Baha'i concept of community is. And it is not a congregation. This is something that Baha'is themselves, Baha'is ourselves, haven't yet got to grips with. It is a transition. There's a letter that the Universal House of Justice wrote to an individual Baha'i that was then shared more widely to all the Baha'is of the world, where the House of Justice said that they, when they looked at the Baha'i community, they saw two types of community. One type of community was very dynamic and powerful and creative and effective, and another wasn't so much. And the difference between the two, they said, was a culture, a difference of culture. And they identified the culture that held some Baha'i communities back as a culture that was inherited from past patterns of religious behavior. And this culture was the culture of the congregation. And they defined this culture as a culture where a few individuals are seen to be qualified to carry on the affairs of the community, whilst the majority passively consume, in a sense, that those services and fit the demands of the community to an agenda dictated by very different purposes. And that's the image we have of religious community. I go to church on Sunday, I listen to the sermons, I hear the deacon, I give in my sort of money, and then I carry on with my life. they said, when a community has not been able to let go of this, they lose two things. One is their spiritual vitality, and the other one is their social relevance. It's really interesting. And I think they come together. Because if you're not relevant, you're not vital, you're not alive. The alternative is the Baha'i vision of community. The House of Justice describes it as a comprehensive unit of civilization that brings together individuals to create systems and institutions that advance the progress of humanity. That's the vision of Baha'i community. So, how do we bring these two streams together that I've opened up? Why? What does it mean to join a Baha'i community or to be part of the Baha'i community or to participate in the Baha'i community? And we'll go into the distinction between those three in a second as by way of conclusion. In the end, the challenges of today at every level, local, national, international, require cooperation, require collaboration, require united action. And that united action requires shared identities. You cannot cohere in a vacuum. And the identities that we've created have been very temporary. But they've been powerful enough that they brought millions of people. So the identity that was created by the anti-war movement, there's a label. I am part of the anti-war movement, was able to cohere millions of people. And that was, you know, through various different ways in which it was expressed. But while it lasted, it was this loose community of people who were willing to label themselves in order to, for their individuality, to have social impact. If they had not labeled themselves, their individual disgust with the war would have had no social impact, or very little. But they came together into a label. Sometimes the label would have been even more narrow, a march on the X of September. On the 13th of September, we will protest. And that became the rallying point of identity that brought everyone together for that moment. But it had slogans, it had a label, it had a point of identity in which to come together. The problem comes when those points of identity are parochial or hostile to other groups. And that's why we are so reluctant. But there's a great saying in English, and very cruel, I think, when you think about it, very graphic, throwing the baby with the bathwater. You know, who does that? Wah! Really cruel. And I don't, you know, no one hears a splat or, you know, the sounds of the social workers coming later or anything else. You just live with that, like you've thrown the baby with the bathwater, and everyone says, yeah, I did. It's like, yeah. You know, nobody calls the police. But in a sense, we've actually done that as a generation. In our fear of labels that isolate us from others, in our fear of labels that manipulate us, in our fear of labels that neutralize us, we have developed a phobia of all labels, and therefore an inability to come together in a constructive way to change the world. So our capacity to change the world at the moment is very, very limited, because it's built around very negative things, no to this, no to that, or very specific things. What the Baha'is offer is a platform for collaboration. Someone asked Shoghi Effendi, it's interesting, this guy was, his name was Marcus Bach, he was not a Baha'i, he was a scholar of religion, of comparative religion, who one of his projects became to interview the 10 people, I think it was, who he thought most closely embodied the spirit of Christ. And one of those people, this was the 1950s, was Shoghi Effendi for him. So he went to speak to Shoghi Effendi, and one of the questions he asked him was, why is Baha'i not making so much noise and growing so much faster than some of the other groups that actually now the Baha'is have grown faster, but at that time, he mentioned a few others. And Shoghi Effendi said something very interesting. He said, at the moment, the message that most religions that want to win converts to their faith is what can we do, what can this faith do for you? Like a supermarket, a consumerist approach to religion. What can I get? If I join this one, what do I get? And if I join this one, what do I get? But the message of Baha'u'llah is, what can you do for humanity? And that's kind of less popular, he said. People see what they love them, kind of. Because in the end, the invitation to the Baha'i community is not an invitation to a congregation to sit and have a nice cup of tea and have a lovely refuge from all those troubles outside. Like, that's part of it. We do have great cups of tea and brilliant Persian rice, you know, in many places. I actually, attained faith through the food, personally, you know, and I remain the poor, but that's just me. But that's not the point. That's not why Baha'is right now in Iran are being imprisoned and are sort of, you know, not able to go to university and all these things. This is not why so much effort is going on. It is not just so that we have spaces where we come together to feel good and nice with like-minded people. That doesn't have enough power. That's irrelevant. It is nice, but it's not what Baha'u'llah came to do. And it's not what the vision of Baha'i community and Baha'i activity should be. And that is something Baha'is are trying to learn very strenuously over the next 15 years or so. What it is, it's a call to work very hard to transform the world. And it is attached to a methodology. How do you change the world? We are so tired of being told how to change the world. There are so many people saying, do this, do that. You should do this. You should invest in that. And we have cause fatigue. Leave me alone. I'll just, you know, do my best in my little corner. I'll do well by my friends and, you know, see, donate to that charity and play my Wii, you know. And the Baha'is recognize this. The Baha'is recognize that the world is tired of words. And that what it requires is a model, a working model. A model that is better than what it already has. A pattern of society, of community that engenders sort of a bridge in a collapsing world order. Something solid that can be offered up. And so far, we have made some considerable progress. This is a non-Baha'i sociologist described the Baha'i community as the single most diverse, unified body of people in the planet, for example. Until the Baha'is hadn't used it. I think now every so often they do. But this was an assessment from someone looking at the evidence of 2,100 ethnic groups being able to act in concert. And we discovered to what an extent in the 1980s in particular, where two things happened. The Baha'i suffered enormous persecution, just like they're again doing so now in Iran. And the Baha'is mobilized as one community to demand the protection and avert genocide in the native land of their faith. And politicians, lobby groups, United Nations, they were shocked to bits. They had never seen anything like it. Because within a period of 3 or 4 months, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, of local government officials, local newspapers, MPs, the United Nations, the Parliament of the European Parliament, the United States Congress, everyone was listening to the same message at exactly the same time, saying, this is happening, stop it. And they arose and they actually did avert a genocide and didn't eradicate persecution, but stopped the killings. The second thing that happened in that decade was 1985. The Baha'is produced a document, the Universal House of Justice wrote a document to the peoples of the world and to the leaders of the world called the Promise of World Peace. This was the height of the World War. We were still one button away from self-destruction. Many people here won't remember it, but some will. I remember it. I was old enough still to know what it was to live under the button, that it just took one drunk president pressing that button and we were gone. And we came close. I heard actually once a documentary that we would have had nuclear war, save for a Russian submarine captain who disobeyed orders, who had been told to press the button. So this is how close we've gotten a couple of times. And at this time, the Universal House of Justice wrote this amazing document to build peace. And the Baha'is again mobilized, like never before. Every corner of society, there wasn't a single world leader that did not receive it. but also through universities, through people, grassroots movement, as millions of Baha'is gave this document, blue booklet, I still remember it, everywhere. It was like all those Baha'is who were alive then had this thing that was part of what being a Baha'i was, you gave up the principle of peace. And the United Nations gave the Baha'is a global prize for peace, a global recognition of the work they had done in creating peace awareness through this grassroots effort. So there's some things that have been accomplished. Having 2,100 ethnic groups, often from different classes, people who might have had legacies of centuries of prejudice and genocide, etc. In Rwanda, in Burundi, I have a dear Rwandan Baha'i friend who was telling me, you said, about the love that has been accomplished in the community. And not for being Baha'is are we immune to the pain of having your child murdered slowly by someone from the opposite tribe, kind of thing. So these are many achievements. But really what the Baha'is are offering is more a vision of potential. But as more people join this community, more becomes possible. And the scale at which this model is able to respond to the needs of a collapsing model increases. And so I'd like to begin to move towards a swift conclusion because time is pressing on. But then asking ourselves again the question of why would I join the Baha'i community? I think there are perhaps a number of levels to this. The first one is purely metaphysical. Well, first of all, why would I join a community full stop, I think? The main reason would be, at this stage, to be able to collaborate with others in improving the world. Because without community, without collective systematic action, as opposed to collective sporadic random action, yay, let's go and save the world, let's, I know, what should we do? Let's clean the streets, yeah. So we clean a street, that's it. Right, let's go, what do we do next? And that's not going to change the world. It's going to make us feel good, and it's going to be a good deed and make us grow spiritually. But the world requires collective systematic action, not just by the world's leaders, but by everyone together. So that's a reason to look for a platform, to look for networks, to look for communities with which to collaborate. Next stage, so how do I choose it? Well, I choose it by my values, which platforms exist out there that represent the values which I feel are required to deal with the crisis of this world. If I find one that represents those values, I have a duty to do my best for it. Because if I don't, I am part of the problem. And I have a duty to be part of the solution. So if I find a platform that shares those values, or many platforms, doesn't have to be just one, any platform that seems to promise the possibility of systematic collaboration to solve the problems of the world is a good platform to join. That requires a certain level of altruism, a certain level of commitment. Not everyone has it. But many people do. Those who do, that's one reason. And this is where many people, many observers, look at the Baha'i community, look at what the Baha'i Faith stands for, look at the way the Baha'i community operates, its democratic, grassroots, community-based functioning, its global perspective, its sort of moral integrity, its harmony between spirituality and social action, and say this is a platform that I would like to support. And then, of course, finally comes that more unquantifiable element that makes me mad, and it's the element of love. And love, Baha'u'llah says, is a light that does not dwell on a heart possessed by fear. When we look at everything that holds us back from cohering with others, whether it be in a relationship with individuals, whether it be as a family, whether it be as a community, it is fear. We are afraid of getting hurt. We are afraid of things not working. We are afraid, and that fear paralyzes our hope. And in the absence of hope, that paralyzes our action. If my hope stretches as far, if I think that the furthest I can get is to that chair, I will never get out of this room, that is for sure. All my efforts will be constrained within this because I don't think I can get any further. If my hope stretches to that door, then even if I don't make it, I know that that's as far as this. The scope of my endeavors will take place in the entirety of this room. This is as regards motion. Likewise, as regards social transformation, if my degree of hope is such that I think all I can do is improve a little bit in this corner, my entire existence and my entire contribution will be limited to that. If I am able to stretch that hope beyond that, I am able to collaborate in a much bigger enterprise. And this brings us back to the first talk originally, which is how do we arrive at belief and at trust? Ultimately, many of us, in the course of examining the Baha'i community and the Baha'i faith, will develop a sense of beauty around it, will find it beautiful, will find Baha'u'llah's life, his teachings, his words beautiful, and that will engender also a desire to follow, to identify ourselves with it. So, then to conclude, how do we bring it all together? In a very recent letter from the Universal House of Justice to the Baha'is of the world about the ways in which we promote the faith directly to people, in neighborhoods, in the streets, everywhere, how we build Baha'i community, they come up with a wonderful formula. They say that our relationship with the Baha'i community and with Baha'u'llah is not an event, it's not a decision. It's a spectrum of spiritual response. It's a wonderful word, a spectrum of spiritual response, which we constantly position and reposition ourselves for the rest of our lives. And they say some people will position themselves not as Baha'is, but as supporters of the Baha'is. That's part of that spectrum of Baha'i community. Others will position themselves as Baha'is, but maybe just sort of wet your toes in the water kind of thing. Others will position themselves completely at the center of the processes of community building of the Baha'i Center. But the important thing is to have a vision of community that is not sectarian. The Baha'i community is not just the Baha'is. The Baha'i community is the Baha'is and everyone who wants to support this vision that the Baha'is are custodians for, to the degree that they are able to. And so we have a community of interest. And this community of interest mobilizes to collaborate with the Baha'is in some of the core activities that Baha'is are doing. So that Baha'is are, particularly at the moment, identifying that the key aspects are education. They are working with children and they are working with sort of youth, the ages 11 to 14 in particular, in trying to equip them to have the kind of mindsets that will allow them to enter youth when they have vigor and flexibility and dynamism, with values and skills that empower them to become servants of humanity. This is an exciting thing, because this is happening in hundreds of countries. You have tens of thousands of groups of young people and children being trained to serve humanity. If you move 10 years from now, what have you achieved? What becomes possible? So many people who are not Baha'is are training to become animators of these junior youth groups or children's class supporters. Others, for example, see there is a dearth of spirituality and they're coming together with Baha'is in devotional meetings and spiritual meetings to be able to empower themselves spiritually, to be able to enchant the world that is fast becoming disenchanted. And then one of the key things that Baha'is are doing is coming together with their friends around a system of workshops around values that are linked again to service to humanity. How do we become enablers of service? And this then spills out to all kinds of levels. We have Baha'i universities, we have sort of incredible interactions with the United Nations. We have individual Baha'is in positions of distinctions, the former Prosecutor General of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, this sort of the deputy director of the United Nations Environment Program, people who, by simply trying to live their faith and live their life and be good people, have risen through their capacity to positions where they are able to serve humanity on a larger scale. And all of this is networked. All of this is united under a common glue, which is the identity that the label Baha'i provides. And suddenly the word Baha'i becomes not a flag, not a tribe, not another denomination, but a tool and an instrument for masses of humanity to come together in transforming the world. So then, in conclusion, the last words I would say in answer to that question, why would anyone join a religion? Well, from a Baha'i perspective, a religion as it is currently understood, nobody in the right mind would. But why would anyone join a community? That's a different question. To fulfill our own potential for service. Because it is only when you give of yourself that you discover what lies hidden within you. And it's only when you collaborate with others that you discover what is distinctive about you, what is unique to you. So you find your individuality through interacting with a collectivity. And you fulfill that collectivity by fulfilling your individuality in service to the whole. And that, I think, is the invitation that the Baha'i community makes to all of us, to position ourselves somewhere in the spectrum of collaboration in bringing about a new world order. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ismail, for that wonderful exposition on that topic. Are there any questions for Ismail?
Or comments or responses?
That's interesting what you were saying. About three quarters of the way through about people. Not wanting to, when you started off with as well, people not wanting to label themselves or label things. And I think labeling goes with discrimination. So I wonder the extent to which people cannot actually tell the difference between certain things now. I don't mean on that sort of superficial level. See the carpet's red, walls are not, there's a lot of yellow in colour. I mean, we can see that. Mm-hmm. And superficially in politics we can see this. One party and another party. I don't think people necessarily are very good at discriminating beyond the surface of things. Mm-hmm. So they can't actually apply labels which are meaningful to them about different organisations or activities. So maybe there's a breakdown of people's ability or a different way that people discriminate. I don't mean in the sense of discriminate against people, but actually understand, distinguish between things. So that things tend to blend together because there's a lack of this sort of awakened faculty of understanding.
Yes, and it's a really interesting point, the role of understanding in creating community and unity and all that. And I agree with you, I think often it's a very just gut reaction, aren't they? They're not really well thought out. They're not necessarily clearly held positioned. It's more a kind of instinct.
So for a slightly more concrete example, it's superficially slightly confusing and maybe contradictory to say that you have an organisation set up to promote unity through diversity. And that actually takes a bit of thinking about. But that's one of the Baha'i things, is that people would be diverse in their approach to things and yet united. But I think that understanding those sorts of things is maybe something that people don't want to engage with so much. I don't know. Maybe they do.
People have a great fear of uniformity, don't they? And they think that diversity can be expanded
between unity and uniformity.
Yeah.
So and not wanting to discriminate in the other sense. Yeah. We don't mind all being in some way uniform, so long as we don't impinge too much on each other.
Right.
I was thinking that you were talking about the people not wanting to belong to things, and I completely agree with everything you've said. I mean, an element that I've thought about as well is the whole, you know, we're at the moment we've brought up without religion, a lot of us, in I would say maybe in England particularly. What somebody would say, as you said, most people would maybe call themselves Christian, but what is a Christian? And I think there's a lot of whether it's it comes from educational systems or from parenting or whatever, this whole element of competition as well. And I think maybe through religion, people, you know, I think the identity that people are seeking can be found through belonging to a community. But at the moment, I think people are seeking a different type of identity. They're looking for to be the individual, to be not interdependent, but independent. And they're looking to how to make their mark in a different way, rather than through a community, through service to the world, etc. Which is where, in my estimation as well, that's where you get the most satisfaction. That's where you truly see who you are, not through the title on the door of your workplace, not necessarily, you know, the award that you've won, etc. But it's through your work and service. So I think at the moment there's just a lot of emphasis on competition, particularly in the West. I think you're brought up to be very competitive, to win that race, to get that title, to be better than the other person, and it's used as healthy competition. Which I don't think it necessarily is, because I think as soon as you have competition, you've got division, and people are not looking to have a common goal, because they're looking to have their own goal. So, what are your thoughts on the whole competition as well, then?
One of the things that's interesting to me about what you were saying is that I think that is one of the, lack of understanding, you know, that people don't think about this through, and there is a misunderstanding that somehow you achieve your individuality by holding on to your isolation, as it were. Like the more disaggregated you are, the more individual you are, and it's actually the other way around. We function by contrast, perception functions by contrast. You only know that there is instead of that black thing because there's a yellow thing behind it. Right? If it all was absolutely the same color, it would be quite difficult to distinguish depth, for example, etc. So the same, I think, in the individual, in fact, it's not that people are necessarily even saying that they're sort of staying away from community or from religious community or from whatever. They are actually still defining themselves in context with others. And I think competition becomes an instrument for that. You kind of discover who you are by interacting with someone else. And in competition, you discover your strengths and your weaknesses. And you say, okay, I'm not as good at this, I am good at that. And the entire system of rewards is based on that, you know, roughly, so you have to promote yourself. But it's part of the same fundamental yearning, I think, which is the yearning to find oneself. And to me, I think that there can be elements where competition can be not unhealthy. It depends on whether it's the over or the isolation of that value, perhaps, from others that can distort it very much. You know? So that if that is the one or the primary means by which you discover who you are, by competing with someone else in a community that is very small, so your workplace or your, on very narrow terms, then likely the level of self-identity you're going to develop will be very fragile, because it will just touch one bit of you. And I think this is where community becomes really important, particularly a religious community, because being also a spiritual aspect, it actually mobilizes the whole of your life. And it allows for interaction at every level of your life with others, which allows you to discover your identity as an individual, your diversity as an individual at every level of your life.
whereas most people perhaps only discover in what ways they're unique, in some superficial aspects. I am uniquely good at writing, or I'm uniquely good at singing, or I'm uniquely good at this. But what about more subtle ways? You know, in we can all love, but we all love in different ways. I'm uniquely good at making someone happy. What a nice thing to discover in oneself, no? Or I'm uniquely good at sort of listening to people in pain and making them feel serene. What an incredible thing to discover about oneself. And it doesn't take away from discovering that one is really good at sort of being a lawyer or whatever. So the thing is then, again, this level of complexity, you know? I think we have to find platforms or labels that are inclusive of as many aspects of ourselves in a harmonious way as possible, you know? And that are based on our personal understanding. That to me is the beauty of it, that no one is of a high who does not join because they understand it to be what they agree with and what they believe in. Now this element of individual persuasion. So it's a community of individuals who share an understanding. That's very powerful, and I think it allows for that individuation. And then the competition can become with oneself, you know? I achieved this last time. You know, and that actually is something that we're doing as Baha'is all the time, you know? Darn, I fell angry 3 times today instead of 2, you know? I'm going to try to make it 1, kind of thing.